now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game with me, Allison Rudd. I'm kidding, of course. It's me, it's Gab McCarty, and I'm back with 40 minutes of football talk with real bite. And by the way, all these biting jokes were written in by the very funny producer Chris Skinner. On the show, we will try to minimize them. We're ready to sink their teeth, Christ, there's another one, into today's program. Rory Smith, Clive Petty, and broadcasting from his conference room in beautiful Rippendon, it's Ollie Kay. They'll be sharing their views on the action at White Hart Lane and the latest developments at Portsmouth. But we have to start at Anfield Road. Okay, Liverpool and Chelsea, I'm assuming we want to talk about the game at some point, but we should start by the big talking point. This isn't the first time.
What's the big talking point?
There you go. Rory Smith, he'll be here all week, ladies and gentlemen. Rory, you're the one here with the advanced degree in psychology. I want to get from you the sense that Ollie calls it a rush of blood, but I can see that. If I were to go and headbutt Skinner right now sitting next to me, right, he might react by reaching out and hitting me or maybe even biting me, right? Well, but it would be an immediate reaction. Here, it's almost like a delayed reaction to grabbing, which is fine, but it's something that he goes through every game. It's not like it's a reaction to a foul which could have hurt or whatever.
I think I know what you mean. I'd shy away from the word premeditated as well. I don't think Luis Suarez was sort of wandering about the penalty area thinking, I mean, I could bite him. I could not bite him, but I also could bite. Yeah, I'll bite him. I think that what we don't know, and there's no point speculating, is whether something has annoyed Suarez and he's done it, or whether, and this is a possibility with Suarez, he's thought in a split second, sort of rush of blood to the head, it might be quite a good idea to bite Ivanovic to try and get him sent off. You know, you bite him, he reacts by punching you, you get him sent off.
I hadn't thought of that, actually. That is a...
I think, as I say, I don't know.
So the idea is I go, like, pretend Skinner's Ivanovic here, I bite him on the shoulder. He reacts, he punches
round.
Me in the face.
Referee sees that, yeah.
Although, obviously, the referee was Kevin Friend, who wasn't watching the game at all and seemed to have his head up in his behind.
There's no point...
But yes, but I think... So you think that is one of the possibilities.
It is a possibility. I think it's more likely that something's just irritated. Suarez, after he gave away the penalty, was clearly very annoyed with the world in general, and I think himself most of all. And I agree with Ollie, I think the problem with Suarez seems to be that in those moments there is nothing in his head that stops it, that makes him think, right, I've got to control myself now. And I take, you know, the argument he plays on the edge, blah blah blah, and that's part of his genius, that's fine, but we, you know, in society, whatever job we do, we have to control our sort of inner animalistic urges. And it's baffling with Suarez that he doesn't seem to be able to do that. He did a brilliant interview with the Sunday Times on Sunday, in which he said that his wife and his friends and blah, 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 all these people tell him he has to control himself more on the pitch. He's obviously conscious of it in his lucid moment. You know, he's aware of it. If you spoke to him today, I'm sure he'd be like, yeah, no, I do need to control myself more. I need to work on this. But he gets on the pitch and he doesn't seem able to do it. And that... I mean, I think biting someone is just plain weird. I can't imagine a scenario, certainly a non sort of amateur scenario in which you bite anybody. It's a weird reaction, but also there's something more troubling, which is Suarez's complete inability to control his emotions. Unless there is a slight possibility that he was trying to get Ivanovic sent off, but as I say, I don't know, so there's no point speculating.
Clive, I want to. All right.
I'm not condoning or endorsing biting in any way, and let me make that extremely clear. But I played rugby to a decent level, and I'm not going to suggest that biting happened all the time. But there were situations where people would, they would go and remove their mouth guard in the bottom of the back, and they would bite. And I played with people from this country, as well as people from Australia and other parts of the world.
More bitey nations.
More like bitey nations, yes. I even played with some Uruguayans, actually, funny enough, but they didn't bite.
Did you play while basted in barbecue sauce?
Yes, generally. I'd say I was only bitten once, but still. But I did witness it.
And it is hidden in rugby. I dare say that nobody actually, while you were playing rugby, ran up to you or tried to catch you on the wing, which I'm sure is where you played, Gab.
Yes, exactly.
tried to get you and actually tried to pull you back by biting your arm. I suspect this happened within scrums and was hidden. You know, this was so blatantly out in the open and play.
Well,
so,
and
that's what's so outrageous
about
it.
The other thing with Suarez is that as I say, he's obviously conscious of this. He's done all this stuff before. At some point, someone has to say to him, look, Lewis, you can't keep doing this. We can't keep making excuses for you. It's the recidivism that's troubling
that's
with Suarez.
The thing, yeah.
Ollie, the thing is, what next? Cause we've seen it before. There's so much outrage. I mean, I watched it on television myself. You know, Graham Souness, Alan Hansen last night. I don't want to say this in a negative way, but they turned into like you're wearing a Liverpool shirt, blah, blah, blah. It's almost as if, you know, if Suarez had been playing for Leeds or something or somebody they didn't like, it would have been okay. But, you know, to them who have a strong connection with Liverpool, they made it made a lot worse, I guess. And there's going to be a lot of outrage, and we probably won't be talking about Di Canio for a while as a result. I want to get from you, in terms of the mechanism, in terms of what's likely to happen when he is charged, assuming he will be charged if he hasn't already been, do they take public outrage and public and sort of media frenzy into account when punishing the guy, or do they tend to be pretty independent and cold-blooded?
I think taking media frenzy into account is always dangerous with these things, whether it's the FA, whether it's...
No, I'm asking you if you think it's a good idea that they take it into account,
Liverpool,
but do they?
Whether it's a government or whatever. No, I don't think they should. I think they should be pragmatic about it, and that pragmatic can also mean making an evaluation and an assessment and thinking, is this guy really worth it? Is he as much worth the trouble as his, to say, is he as much trouble as he's worth? I mean, he is worth an awful lot as a footballer. He's one of the best players in the world, certainly one of the very best in the Premier League. And yet, because of all this baggage, because of the reputational damage that comes with him, and it's damaging to the team as well, because it means that he misses chunks of seasons as he takes chunks out of I probably won't go there, but it is a reasonable decision dilemma for Liverpool. I think they would be wrong to just say, on a moral ground, we must sell this guy. I think morally, what happened last season was worse, I would suggest, than whatever this sort of rush of blood was yesterday. But the fact is that it all adds up to the Suarez baggage, and it makes him nothing like the asset as a footballer that he should be. While they should take internal action, while they should fine him, and they have fined him, and the money is going to the Hillsborough Family Support Group, it's not very easy to say they should sack him, because since when did a club ever sack a player in those circumstances, except when it was a player they were desperate to get off the wage bill? No club does that.
If I'm Scudamore right now, and I'm going to pull a really long face, and this is really bad for the Premier League, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? It's more publicity. It's WWE stuff. Okay? Like, all right, so look, I've got this bad boy Nutter who goes around, bites somebody. In the end, Ivanovic isn't hurt. I have to suspend him and whatever else. He broke the rules. But this isn't, it's not like people are saying, oh, look, the Premier League is a horrible place and so on. Aren't people going to stop watching? This is more customers, more eyeballs, more people talking about the product, more people probably praising Liverpool for taking a hard stand against them. I'm trying to think, like, who's really aggrieved by this apart from Liverpool if the situation gets so bad where they feel they need to sell him? And if they feel they need to sell him because they're motivated sellers, they will end up selling him for less than he's worth. From Suarez's perspective, if that happens, if they have to sell for less than he's worth, it's only good for him because that means he'll sign a bigger contract wherever he goes.
I take your point. I mean, obviously, Scudamore's not part of the disciplinary process because it's the FA.
Well, we're saying, like, if you're Scudamore right now, are you really that, like, are you really pulling your hair out?
The Premier League have never shown themselves to be, certainly that I can think of, Ollie may disagree, particularly averse to the kind of benefits of, yeah, the kind of sports entertainment style heroes and villains narrative, the kind of the stories of failure and redemption, all that stuff. They don't seem to mind that. The Premier League don't really make a play of their sort of product being, yeah, whiter than white and kind of for the pure and, you know, completely kind of innocent and all
there's
that.
Nothing I think, wrong with that.
No. This isn't a moral judgment. Yeah, I think from the Premier League, it kind of adds to this. This great Suarez as a character adds to this great kind of soap opera feel to it, which marks me out maybe as someone who had too much time on their hands as a child. But yeah, there is a lot. There's a lot of traits of professional wrestling in modern football, and I think that's kind of most powerful in the Premier League.
Who's the damaged party here? I mean, apart from
Suarez's reputation suffers, obviously. I think Liverpool's reputation does suffer as a brand. It's bad for Liverpool. The Premier League, probably not. Football will recover. You know, there's been worse things that happen in football. There's this weird kind of morality with certain things. I was going to do a blog today, but decided I couldn't be bothered with the abuse on Twitter, saying that this idea that spitting is the worst thing that you can do on a football pitch, I've always found really weird.
I wrote that a decade ago, but yeah.
I'd much rather be spat at than have my leg broken, personally. I mean, it's a bit grim, but it's not. And it does potentially spread TB, a disease that's on the up in London, Gab, as I'm sure you know.
I think, Ollie, I want to make a hierarchy of bad things you can do, right? But somebody on Twitter last night made the point along the Rory Smith lines, I guess, that this is very bad, but is it really worse than, you know, Roy Keane and Alfie Haaland? Deciding that he's going to intentionally go and injure an opponent and hopefully end his career, and then going and writing about it in his book. I would argue that morally, ethically, that is a million times, maybe not a million times, but it's several magnitudes more reprehensible than this, because it's entirely premeditated and cold-blooded. And yet, this guy who does it, who incidentally also, and this is one of my weird perversions, happens to be one of my favorite footballers, he's somebody who's feted and is wonderful and, you know, is has a budding media career.
Mm. Well, Keane wasn't exactly canonised at the time. He was hauled over the coals by the media, by the FA at the time. But
is it worse than is that worse than what Suarez did?
Well, yeah, I would argue it was. But that was in 2001, and people were, you know, hysteria wasn't quite like it, and the media coverage wasn't like it was. Like it is now. I mean, I remember covering all that, and it was a big deal. But this is bigger because it's 12 years later, and you know, there's the whole sort of Twitter, social media, you know, rolling news aspect to it, which means that you know that there is a huge hysteria about it. But I mean, I would argue that the I've had people sort of tweeting me saying, you know, how is this worse than you know, a leg breaking tackle, an elbow, etc. And you can say, well, yes, this probably hardly left a mark on Ivanovic, but it's worse in terms of, you know, you are going to get an awful lot of coverage of anybody biting anybody. If it was, if it was any two Premier League players involved in a biting incident, then it's going to be huge. It's going to be a bigger deal than a bad tackle, a Callum McManaman style tackle.
Well, just
if it's Suarez, who's got previous, not only for this but for various other things, then of course there's going to be more coverage because that's how it works.
Moving on to the game as well. Again, I don't want to pick on the referee. The Sturridge on Bertrand tackle, the way that at one point it looked like Jamie Carragher was actually controlling the game, not in a bad way, but because Kevin Friend seemed to be lost on the pitch. Ollie, I want to get this from you. Sometimes when we have sort of, I guess, for lack of a better word, tier two referees or guys, you know, who aren't in that sort of web, Mariner, whatever, echelon, people give them big games to see if they can step up. Is it fair to say that, you know, Friend didn't really seize the day and had a bad day at the office?
Yeah, and it didn't actually seem like a particularly sort of feisty, bad-tempered game. It seemed like there were just a series of incidents, sort of unrelated incidents along the way that the referee and the officials somehow missed. I mean, you could add the Torres...
Torres elbow.
To the Torres elbow. Yep. I mean, on a different day, the back page, you know, you know how we all love player X faces a disciplinary charge type headline on a Monday morning. You know, on a different day, the back pages might have been all about that. Yet somehow the referee saw it and only gave the yellow card. The referee didn't do well, but it was a good game though, wasn't it?
it's
in other news.
Chelsea will have a grievance. I mean, I'm not quite sure. They'll have a grievance anyway, because 7 minutes?
Yeah, I'm not sure where the seven minutes came from.
What was that about anyway?
This is what I was told, Ollie, since you're all-knowing, maybe you can confirm this, that the reason they played so much was because the substitutes board was up at the 90th minute, if somebody was making a substitution. And so what happens is, apparently, was what I was told, they can't start counting the time until the substitution has been complete. So the board actually went up later than it would, and it sort of added another 45 seconds. Does that make any sense to you?
It does make sense, but as you well know, Gav, because we disagreed about it before, I think that the complaining about stoppage time is just a, you know, it's a nonsense, really. I think people get very hung up about it. Top Premier League managers seem to get very hung up about it. I never seem to hear much of that from managers who haven't managed in the Premier League.
We've had this discussion before. Ollie and I disagree, but some of us are in favor of real-time 2:30-minute halves. Stop the ball every time it goes out of play. Balls are still dead. Not only do you not have these issues, you also don't have time-wasting. But Ollie, who clearly loves time-wasting and extended minutes at the end so the bigger team can go and score the goal against a smaller team and generally loves cheating, is against real-time. That's an accurate characterization, Ollie?
I just like long stoppage time, because long stoppage time just gives you more time to finish off your match report.
That's a good point.
And gives you I'll remember you said that, Mr. K.
and just gives you the slightest chance of getting in before the deputy football editor is screaming down the phone.
All right, let's move on to what I thought was going to be the game of the weekend, Spurs and City, and what turned out to be kind of an entertaining game, certainly an entertaining finish, but was obviously overshadowed to some degree by Anfield. Clive, for 70 minutes, I thought City just completely dominated the game, and I thought that Mancini did everything right. And I don't want to say AVB did everything wrong, but I thought Gareth Bale was unfit. I thought Adebayor was poor again. And then it all changes.
Funnily enough, it seemed to all change. Yeah, I mean, supposed to be able to give AVB the credit for finally making those changes, and they did make an effect. I thought City were incredibly comfortable, you're right, for 50, 60, 70 minutes. Adebayor was just a figure on a pitch. He was just filling space, as far as I can work out. Very tall figure. Bale didn't seem very comfortable playing kind of behind him, and was kind of felt restricted playing that kind of centrally. It seemed to help as soon as Defoe came on, and there was someone with a bit more movement. Huddleston came on, and again a bit more movement, and could spray the ball about, and Bale could drift out, and Tottenham suddenly found a bit of width. It was all very restricted for the first half. It was all very central. As soon as they found a bit of width, things changed. I'm not quite sure why City changed that, but I mean, they didn't. They certainly did not seem to be the same team in the second half. Whether Mancini's to blame for that, I don't know. But I don't think it was entirely down to that.
Ollie, you were there. I know for a fact Mancini is completely nonplussed and blamed a series of individual mental switch-offs, and I think he generally feels that he laid his team out correctly and he did the right thing, and it was a series of errors. Certainly, Vincent Kompany will want to forget that game, but he's not the only one. Gareth Barry tying his shoe while the ball's... I mean, it's just stuff that you just don't expect. But was that your take of those weird last 20 minutes?
Yeah, they just did seem to switch off individually and collectively. And I mean, you look at a game like that where a team is in such total control and cruising, and then sometimes the opposition just up their game in the closing stages, and it takes the team that you're leading by complete surprise, and they can't deal with it. I mean, that's happened so many times down the years, and it's why you get those sort of late turnarounds so often, really. I thought City did switch off, and I hadn't been aware of the Gareth Barry shoelace incident, but Kompany did seem to switch off. I thought they defended brilliantly till that point, not necessarily in terms of very visible defending, but just being very solid, but you know, leaving very little space. Bale in particular was completely neutralised, and then Spurs made the switches and City didn't react, and you know, by the time they could react, they were 3-1 down.
That felt like quite an important moment for City. I don't know. I mean, Mancini's not the mood music seems to be that they'll stick with him for another year, that they feel he's earned that kind of second chance to regain the title. But you look at things like that, just the sort of lackluster, sort of slightly slapdash way to end the game. When, you know, theoretically, they're not entirely out of the title mathematically yet. Obviously, they are in reality.
And by the time people hear this, United could be champions.
Yeah, I realise that. But if City had won, that wouldn't have been the case.
No.
So, and to be honest, they probably should have won. There's something about City, and there has been all season, where they seem completely incapable of kind of... Well, to be honest, like really caring. They don't seem to really care, and they haven't cared all season. And that's the sort of thing. I personally think managers get too much criticism. They're expected to control too many elements, but that's something that is very much the manager's responsibility.
I mean, they managed to do it for the past the two previous games. I mean, against United and against in the semi-final. Yeah. I mean, that was a fantastic performance, right? You know, that's the City that should have been, and the City that kind of turned up for 45-50 minutes yesterday. But as you're right, why that suddenly think, well, it can't be just because it's only Tottenham and this is easy, and you know, we're not going to win the title, we're not nothing to play for here. That can't be right. And if that is the case, that probably is.
Well, yeah, that means you can lose the edge when you feel as though you've got nothing to play for. You see that with mid-table sides all the time. Although Alisson actually denies that completely, that whole phenomenon exists. But you do see mid-table sides sort of, you know, gets to Charlton syndrome, sort of get to March, not really bothered, happily, you know, lose nine games on the bounce, finish 14th instead of 9th. But with City, they kind of do have something to play for, in the sense that they have pride to restore to an extent after a disappointing year. And you've got to imagine a lot of those players are playing for their futures, because Mancini, if he stays or whoever replaces him, will want to upgrade a lot of positions. Just like, I know that City have got the best squad in the league, but you look at the first team and there's not that many that you... I mean, apart from sort of Silva, Aguero, Kompany...
Nastasic
is fantastic. Kompany when he's playing well, and Yaya Toure when he looks like he's in any way interested. Joe Hart's gone backwards this year.
I don't know, you can say that.
You can't say that because you get loads of abuse, but he's gone backwards. Joe Hart looks to me like a goalkeeper who is believing his own hype.
The issue with City, I mean, I wouldn't get overly hung up on what happened in the final 20 minutes yesterday, because I mean, the fact is that with five matches, well, I mean, assuming that United win, you know, beat Aston Villa or are champions sooner or later, City will have been out of the title race, even mathematically, with five matches remaining. I think everybody would agree, even United supporters, that this is not a classic Manchester United team, and yet a multi-talented, star-studded Manchester City squad, regardless of the fact that they missed out on Van Persie, are out of mathematical contention with five matches remaining. That is dreadful. added to the Champions League failure. That is dreadful too. I mean, yes, they're probably going to win. Well, they're in the FA Cup final. I would expect them to win the FA Cup final, but I think it's been a dreadful season for City. What could they finish with? 80 points, something like that. I think that's even if they win all their games, I think that is nothing like enough for a squad of that capability. And it asks serious, serious questions of.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Mancini and of the attitude of the players. It's a big, big failure.
Okay, so while we may not have much of a title race after tonight, we do have a rather exciting race for the Champions League, for those who care about them. We know Arsene Wenger cares about it. Somehow, Arsenal are third in the table. I'm just going to go through this very quickly because we all need a quick prediction and a reminder. Arsenal are in third place on 63 points, Chelsea 62, Spurs 61. Chelsea and Spurs do have a game in hand. Ollie, how do you see this panning out?
Well, I said Arsenal-Chelsea at the start of the season. I think I moved to Spurs and Chelsea at that point where Arsenal were 7 points adrift. But I think I'll revert to my original prediction and say Arsenal and Chelsea. I mean, it's easy.
So basically, based on what the table says, you change your prediction?
Well, yes, because that's probably what's more likely to happen and because those teams are more experienced, etc. But there's also, whatever happens, there's going to be an absolutely minimal points difference between third and fifth and probably third and sixth, and yet we're going to get enormous wailing about whichever club manages fifth. We're going to get, Wenger's completely lost the plot if they finish fifth on goal difference, or we're going to get AVB's a flop if Spurs finish fifth. And it's, whether teams finish third, fourth, fifth does not really make a huge difference to me about the job that manager's done this season.
Roy, and bear in mind, of course, that Chelsea have Europa League commitments as well.
And they also have a harder run in. They've still got to go to United, although they might have won the title by that stage. Probably will have won the title by that stage. They've got to play Spurs. They've got to play Everton. I would be inclined to say Arsenal and Spurs just on the ease of the run in. But I agree with Ollie completely. I think that...
And because you don't rate Rafa?
No, I agree with Ollie. I think that yeah, there will probably be sort of a maximum of kind of 3 points between third and fifth, and that's one win over the course of the season, and huge conclusions will be drawn from that. And I think that's talking about the Suarez thing. You know, that's the problem with the way that the amount of media saturated coverage that there is of football, that we have to take fairly minor kind of random events and pretend that they're enormously significant. I think it probably will be Arsenal and Spurs because of the run-ins, but it may well be Arsenal and Chelsea.
Clive?
Or Chelsea Spurs?
It could even be Chelsea Spurs. Could even be that.
Could even
be,
yeah.
I predict it will be one of those three combinations.
Can you kick it up several notches? Come on, Everton. Can you give us some quality analysis here, please?
No. Because I refuse to talk about Arsenal coming third. It just goes against everything I kind of want to say. I still think Spurs can do it. As you say, Chelsea they're running. I mean, you know, was it? They've still got to play three games a week from now until doomsday. I think that's going to tell. I think that's just bound to tell, effectively. And I think because they will desperately try to get to the Europa League final, because Rafa desperately wants to win something, so he's not going to jeopardise that. The Spurs-Chelsea game will become pivotal, and I think that will hold the key to the finals, to the final place, to be quite honest.
Isn't it amazing that Arsenal could well finish third? Just remarkable.
Yeah, I've gone against this thing of... I said this at the time, this whole media storm of writing Arsenal off, and this is the worst thing. I thought, this is just far too early. We do this all the time. This is the worst Arsenal team going, and I still believe they were going to get into the top four.
Oh no, this is the worst Arsenal team.
Yeah, well, it kind of is, but it's just it's a testament to the sort of mediocrity of the Premier League. I think that they still managed to do it.
No more criticism of the Premier League or Premier League associated products, please. Sorry.
Barclays Premier League. Come on.
Exactly. No more criticism of the Barclays Premier League, please. I'm just going to throw this out there, and you can give me feedback on it, but especially seeing how tight it is with the Champions League race and the relegation race, and seeing how stupid and meaningless goal difference is, the finish level on points. How cool would it be, Arsenal and Spurs finishing level on points for fourth place and, like, having a one-game playoff for the Champions League.
Yeah, I'd
played at Wembley. Wouldn't that be cool?
Because Spurs would win that, because that's what we do now. We can now beat the bigger teams, and it's what Arsenal don't do anymore. So, I'd go for that, strangely enough.
Exactly. Instead, because Arsenal have a goal difference of plus 30 and Spurs have a goal difference for plus 17.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you'll be watching Arsenal on TV and enjoying your Thursday nights. Moving on to our debate this week, we're going to talk some Portsmouth. Now, as you may know, Portsmouth, after a succession of rather unfortunate owners and administration as well, they've been relegated from League One. But the good news is they're now out of administration. They had an out-of-court settlement with the old owners, and there's now a Portsmouth Supporters Trust, which is in charge of the club. Now, I'm assuming nobody here wants to argue that supporters' trusts and fans in charge is an inherently bad idea, and we should all have wealthy owners, ideally ones living in offshore tax havens. I'm looking at you, Clive.
I'd like to be a wealthy offshore tax haven club owner. That'd be great.
The club you support is owned by one, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, nobody wants to argue that supporters' trusts are bad, so it won't be much of a debate on that one. But, Ollie, I want to get from you, what needs to happen? We all like the idea of it, right? But one of the pitfalls potentially with supporters' trusts, and one of the arguments the Premier League has made against supporters' trusts in the past, is that, hey, guys, be careful, because when everybody's in charge, nobody's in charge, and there have been a bunch of supporters' trusts that have run up huge amounts of debt and not been responsible in certain cases. Others have been good. I mean, do you think that's a valid criticism?
Well, I think if you look at the way various clubs are run, if you said which are the clubs which are run from an overly emotional unobjective, imbalanced manner, you wouldn't be talking about Exeter City and AFC Wimbledon and you know, this type of club. You would be talking about Blackburn Rovers, Queen's Park Rangers.
We might be talking about Bournemouth.
Bournemouth are a huge success.
Ollie, I don't follow the lower leagues, but if Dan Johnson were here, he would no doubt point to half a dozen supporter trust owned clubs that ran into, or supported trust run clubs that ran into trouble. I think in the interest of balance, you know what those clubs are. You ought to be able to mention them, right?
Well, yeah. No, I mean,
which ones are they?
Well, one example is, I mean, Notts County were in the ownership of their supporters, and then guys came along from this Qatari group supposedly called Munto Finance in, what was that, 2008, 2009, something like that. And they sold, you know, they thought this was the club's golden ticket, and these shadowy, mysterious owners who were con men basically took the club into enormous problems, from which, you know, the club's since stabilised. But I think there are any number of examples which show that a sensible group of supporters, investors, call it what you like, would be a great deal better than the options in many cases. And obviously there are many instances. You look at somebody, a club like West Brom are very well run and run by, you know, a rich guy who's low profile and doesn't sink enormous amounts in, but the club is well run. You know, would their club be better run, you know, better placed than the ownership of their supporters? Probably not, but there are many clubs that would be.
Roy, I generally think that believe in supporters' trust as, if not outright owners, at least with a strong presence at the club, basically because I am convinced that football is murky and there are a lot of thieves and charlatans in football who steal money from football clubs. And I think or run clubs badly or in a very risky way. And I believe in oversight and transparency, and I like to believe that if supporters have representation or ownership, we are going to be guaranteed that. Is there another benefit apart from that? Because you got to weigh that against the fact that, you know, a supporters' trust might have more difficulty, for example, raising money for capital investment than Lakshmi Mittal.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that it's great news for Portsmouth that they've become supporter-owned, but I think the thing that the club will have to, the fans generally, not necessarily the fans who are involved in the ownership scheme, but the sort of general supporter base will have to accept is that there is a... That place is like a natural limitation on what they can expect to achieve. They're going to go down into League Two. The funds that they'll be able to raise, I would have thought, will be enough to compete and probably with the size of the club succeed in League Two. Probably same is true of League One, maybe the Championship. But you have to spend an awful lot of money to get up into the Premier League and do well in the Premier League. And that's where the limitation of the idea of the sort of, yeah, the mixed model, I guess, would be the solution, where you have supporter representation, whether that's at 25% like Swansea or 51% like it has to be in Germany, and then the rest of the money kind of comes from either someone like Adidas or T-Mobile, like it is at Bayern Munich, or a company or an owner or whatever. That's maybe a better model. But pure supporter ownership, given how much Premier League clubs A are worth to buy, but B, more importantly, need to spend, does place a natural limitation. And the supporters, I think, at Portsmouth will have to display a patience with this structure, because it is a positive, but it's not the same as having an Abramovich or a Lakshmi Mittal come in and chuck billions at it. But I agree with you. I think that football clubs are not normal businesses, shouldn't be run like normal businesses. There is a responsibility to the communities which bore them and which support them. And yeah, obviously we're all for fan ownership, but it's not kind of a panacea to all of a club's problems at all.
Clive, now that there's a version of financial fair play, obviously in the Football League, there may be one coming in the Premier League as well. I still don't understand, because one second it seems like, oh, it's definitely happening and it's some sort of evil plot by certain clubs. Other times, I think there's still a lot of things they have to iron out. Might that help facilitate the rise of supporter-run clubs, because the competition aren't going to be able to go and spend 100, lose 100 million pounds that year? Then
I suppose if we're saying if those financial fair play restrictions exist, then yeah, there is a level of which nobody goes above, and it gives you some sort of ceiling or something to aim at. As long as you say, clubs are sensible, then they're presume not-for-profit organisations, sort of supporters trust things. If they don't fall into the... as long as they keep their fandom at one level and keep it on a business level, because if they start chasing that idea of, we'll stick with Portsmouth, they're in League Two, we've got to get to League One, that guy who's going to get us, I don't know, 20 goals, let's go and splash out on whatever.
That did happen, didn't it? That's one of the examples of it was one of the North West clubs, Rochdale or Macclesfield or Stockport or someone like that, where the fans took over and the decisions that were made were not particularly sensible in the long term.
Well, they backfired. I mean, I think
that is a problem.
That's the gamble, yeah. I mean, as long as they... I think quite sensibly that, there's a representation, I think, at Portsmouth of, the supporters' trust, but then there is an actual board of people, of sensible business people, who, if they stay sensible business people, there's a chance that this most definitely succeeds.
The weird thing is that football clubs aren't complicated businesses at all.
No.
Someone told me once that in terms of a business model, you basically know what your incomings are and you basically know what your expenditure at. It's every year. It's, you know, you get your season ticket money, your TV money, all that stuff, and then you have to pay people's wages and maintain the ground and, you know, have a groundsman and all that. It's a fairly, they're small, even the biggest football clubs are not sort of complicated companies to run in the manner of, say, a GM or whatever, another big company.
And yet they're constantly Vodafone. Crying and moaning and bitching and stuff like that. The Premier League, can you need to give us more money, blah, blah, blah.
No, I'm not saying...
But it's amazing, though, like how much these people whinge when in reality attendance, especially in the lower leagues, is at the highest it's been in like 40 years and people still can't run clubs properly. I'm not talking about supporters. I'm talking about individual owners.
How much money comes down from the Premier League is a different issue, but in terms of...
They can go like, oh, look, I can't run my own business, so let me go. And it's kind of like, you know, imagine Skinner's wealthy and good because he's wealthy, and I don't have a pot to go to the bathroom in because I've gambled it away buying some striker from League One, and then I go and I demand that Skinner gives me money. I mean, it becomes a shakedown at that point.
But the ultimate stakeholders in football are the fans, and the Premier League still don't seem to quite grasp the idea that they're... The current model where anyone can come in with, you know, leverage with debt or whatever and take over a club is something that a lot of people kind of resent. And I think until you get to a tipping point, the Premier League won't acknowledge that at all. Just for them, everything's fine. They're really successful. They got loads of money. You know, it's most watched league in the world, all of that. It's getting bigger and bigger all the time. Until there becomes a tipping point, and I don't know what shape that would take, I don't think they're that bothered about having fan representation at clubs. I don't have the impression they really care.
It's a classic, I think, Turkey's Christmas situation, right. Of course, because, you know, I think Scudamore might sit there and be like, this would be better for the Premier League business model if we had more transparency or if we did this or that. But ultimately, while sometimes it might seem like he's lord and master of the Premier League, he's not really. It's the 20 clubs who vote on it, and he's got to abide by what they want to do. And probably doesn't take too much imagination to imagine that certain owners of football clubs, say Bermuda-based billionaires who get their education and their benefits from this country, but then decide to go there solely because they don't want to pay the same amount of taxes, or perhaps absolute monarchs of countries with very dubious human rights records might not want Scudamore or his accountant snooping around their business. All right, enough of the fan stuff. Time for some quick hits. Queen's Park Rangers lose at Stoke, and Redknapp says he wishes he tried harder to sign Peter Odemwingie from West Brom. Rory, is this the last nail in Rangers' coffin? And would Peter O have made that much of a difference?
I think it is the last nail in Queen's Park Rangers' coffin. I think that they are still mathematically capable of getting to safety, but maths aren't all they're cracked up to be. I thought it was really strange that Redknapp kind of said that was the turning point of the season. Peter Odemwingie's not Pele, do you know what I mean? He wouldn't have suddenly turned them into a world-class outfit. But I think it's much easier for Redknapp to say, oh, if we'd signed Odemwingie, things should have been different, rather than to say, I've come in and singularly failed to generate any sort of cohesion or team spirit within my players.
Townsend, Genus, I thought all these guys brought great teams.
Townsend's done okay, to be fair. Townsend's not bad. Genus is a pointless footballer.
Wayne Rooney enters the final 2 years of his contract at Old Trafford in June. Ollie, will he get a new deal? And I sense a general malaise around the boy dating back to the mysterious injury he suffered that nobody knew about a couple weeks ago. Why does everybody seem so down on him?
Well, it's a good question. I think there's been a sense, I mean, it's not a media issue. I think the media are reflecting negative vibes towards Rooney from within United, from within the club. And I think there's been a sort of loss of patience with him from Ferguson in particular. There's been a frustration that his form this season, and his form probably since his new contract 2 years ago, has not been great. And I wouldn't put a great deal of money on him being there next season. I think it's a very difficult one to call because it's not immediately clear where he would go. But there is a situation there which is undoubtedly worth monitoring. Keep your eye on James Ducker, who is very much on top of this situation.
Should always keep your eye on James Ducker.
I'm sure we'll be going back to this one, but I just find it completely absurd. But he's going to be United's all-time leading goal scorer by the time he's 30. And statistically, this is one of his best ever seasons. And United have won the league by an enormous margin. Andy Carroll is now Flavor of the Month again after some good performances for West Ham. Clive, is he top four material?
I'm not sure whether he's... what's he done? He scored and leapt high again and made another goal, isn't he? I mean, that's...
He also laid out David De Gea, too.
Yeah, that was funny, wasn't it? I kind of like that. I thought that was fantastic.
So you haven't changed your mind on Andy Carroll?
No, I haven't changed my mind on Andy Carroll. He's if we're talking the top four, I'm not sure which top four club that's going to benefit.
Is he Liverpool material? If not top four?
Well, not Brendan Rodgers' Liverpool material, I'd have thought. No, they're not going to play like that. But
can he bite people?
Yeah.
Stop it. You're just being so mean to Andy Carroll. Tough week for Wigan as they lose two games from which they probably deserved more. Rory, if they go down, will Roberto Martinez's job prospects suffer as a result? And should they?
I'm considering doing this entire answer in a Speedy Gonzalez Mexican accent like you just used. I think I get the impression Martinez, in one sense, should have jumped maybe last summer when I think Villa and Liverpool obviously were in for him, because it looks increasingly like Wigan's luck might run out. But that said, I don't think there's any shame at all in Wigan going down in terms of the wages to pay, the squad they have, and they've got to the FA Cup final, which obviously is a remarkable achievement for him.
Is it really?
Well, given
I looked who they played along the way. They played absolute draws.
Yeah, but do you know what?
Except for Everton.
Gab, do you know what? That's not unique in terms of teams.
To be fair, you know, funny because they played absolute draws, but he played his reserves in most of those games right up until the quarterfinals, which I thought was absolutely extraordinary.
But
hence my Golobar reference earlier today.
That's not unusual in terms of sort of smaller teams who make it to the cup final. That's kind of the glory of the cup. Martinez is still a good manager. He will still get a good job, but I think he is reliant on the right sort of job becoming available this summer. So I'm not sure he's furthered his career. Going down, I don't think will necessarily damage his reputation.
Notice how he was Martinez when Rory started his answer and then became Martinez towards the end of his answer.
Martinez.
Paolo Di Canio leads Sunderland to another win, 1-0 over Everton. Ollie, you were sceptical when the great man was appointed. What do you make of it thus far?
I was sceptical, you're right, and I'm impressed by the impact he's made. I mean, two wins from three games has almost certainly kept Sunderland up, and look at their remaining fixtures. I would expect them to win more now that they've got that feel-good factor back. He's done a really good job, not just from a point of view of enthusiasm, though I think that's a very important part of his makeup as a manager, but tactically they look good, they look solid, they're working for each other. They do appear more energetic, fitter than they did 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's what we would have two seasons ago we were calling the O'Neill effect.
Arsenal win at Fulham. Jack Wilshere can seemingly only play 20 minutes or so per match because of some injury that Wenger fears he may re-aggravate and which nobody seems to really understand, and yet they're on course for third place. Clive, we touched upon this earlier, but if they do finish third, should all of Wenger's critics eat humble pie, or should we move back results and judge this season on something other than simply point, you know, wins, draws, and losses and conclude, hey, it's time for a change?
No, I don't think they should eat humble pie. I don't think, as I touched on earlier, I think they've been on a good run recently, which has got them into this position, allied with a few poor results for their rivals. I don't think they've done anything that they shouldn't have done, i.e. beating the likes of Fulham. I think they should be expected to do that. And I think they are still a top four team. It doesn't alter the fact that, unless we're saying that Arsenal's sole objective now is purely to be a top four team, it should surely be a title-challenging top four team, in which they are quite patently not. So no, I don't think we should apologise to Wenger. We've still got to sort out a lot of problems there to make that team what they were a few years ago, 8 years ago. You know, so true journalist star Roy Smith has made his excuses and left. So, Gab, it's Champions League semi-final time. How are Europe's final four preparing?
Well, it was a mixed bag there, Clive. Real Madrid, I think they're going to be fine injury-wise. Marcelo is a bit of a doubt, but they warmed up by beating Betis 3-1. Didn't play particularly well, but they also played all the scrubs. Barcelona mixed things up again as well against Levante. Messi still a doubt, supposedly, but I think he will play. I don't think there's much issue there. Nice to see Abidal play 90 minutes. Actually looks really, really good after his second tumor operation, although I don't think he's going to feature midweek, but they do have some major question marks at the back. Bayern Munich romped all over Hanover 6-1. Neuer made a tremendous ricket. For some reason, for a very good goalkeeper, he makes enormous howlers occasionally, but everything's fine with them. And Borussia Dortmund beat Mainz, and curiously, Klopp decided to, unlike everybody else, play his starters, believing, I guess, that they need, believing in rhythm and momentum, I guess. That's all we got time for this week. It's been fun. It's been real. It's been real fun. Thanks to my guests, Rory Smith, who has left the room to go to the bathroom, Clive Petty, and, of course, Ollie Kay. You can find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or you can email us, as so many of you do every single week. It's gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You can, of course, go to thetimes.co.uk for all your news, your views, your web chats, your blogs, your analysis. Tomorrow, a special day, Tuesday, you get both a web chat from me and a blog. Isn't that nice? And, of course, you can follow us all on Twitter. Rory especially likes it when you hurl abuse at him. Ollie and me, not so much. Clive, not at all, I would imagine. Till next time, bye-bye.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.